You're listening to Investigation Insiders by Integris Intelligence.
Hello again, everyone. Hope you are all doing well and staying safe. Welcome to another episode of Investigation Insiders. We have another great guest today, the world famous Bob Silbering. Welcome, Bob. How are you?
Well, hi, thank you. It's great to be with you as always. And I wouldn't say exactly I'm world famous, but maybe U.S. famous, but okay.
Well, listen, after reading your book and doing a bunch of research on you, I would argue that that line didn't come about by accident. So I usually start with telling people about how I know the guests, right, Bob? So Bob, by the way, one of the neat facts about him is his memory. He's got an unbelievable memory. I'm not sure if he'll remember exactly the details of how we met, but I do. So many, many years ago, when we were still in the early stages of building our business, I reached out to Robert Tucker, the CEO of T&M USA, to pick his brain about how he built his business. He was incredibly gracious to meet with me and has been a tremendous supporter of Integris ever since. So we met, and then he took me over to an office sort of like in the corner of their office space, and he says, this is the guy I need to introduce you to. So he takes me into Bob's office, and I just remember the piles of paper on your desk, Bob, and the phone just ringing off the hook, right? And so that was our first meeting. And of course, many years later, we've all had the chance to do a lot of work together on many, many occasions, and obviously built a friendship during the process. So hopefully that summarizes it somewhat, Bob.
Right. And you were very gracious because you took me out to lunch and paid the bill.
So I did.
I was very grateful for that.
That's a separate podcast in and of itself. So again, for the 2 to 3 people that don't know who you are, maybe you could just provide a brief overview of yourself.
Okay. So I was, I just wrote a book, Law and Disorder, How a Kid from the Bronx Became America's Top Drug Prosecutor. And it's really, a Horatio Alger story. I came from a lower middle class family in the Bronx, and I wasn't a great student. I never really had much interest in school, but by the time I got to college, I matured. And I decided I wanted to go to law school because I always had an interest in crime. I always loved to watch The Untouchables and all the law shows that were out there, and crime shows, the FBI, all these shows. And finally, I decided to go to law school. But what happened was there was a war going on in Vietnam, and I couldn't go to law school because I would have been drafted. I had a low number. I ended up teaching in Paterson, New Jersey, which some can say is close to being in Vietnam at the time. And I went at night, and then I went to law school I got my deferment by teaching, and then I went to law school at night. I did 4 years at night. And then I saw that there was an opportunity to become a paralegal in the Manhattan DA's office, which was the most highly respected local prosecutor's office in the country. And I got an interview. I was hired. I was a paralegal for a year. And then when I graduated law school, I applied for a position there, and I was hired. And I was hired, fired, and rehired, actually. I was hired by Frank Hogan, who then became ill and had to resign. And then the governor appointed Richard Q as the interim DA before there's a special election. And then Q said, well, I'm not going to hire honor all the people that were hired by Hogan. So he fired everybody who were given a job opportunities. And but then he decided, I'll re-interview some of these people and maybe I'll rehire them. And he re-interviewed me and hired me, and that's how I got my start. And then I moved up the ladder. And then for some reason, I'm in the office for 3 years, and Robert Morgenthau, who's now the DA and ended up being the DA from 1975 to 2009, called me into his office one day and said, you know, the law has changed in New York and prosecutors can now try cases in the family court. And he asked me to start up a new unit called the Juvenile Offense Bureau. And I was there, and all of a sudden, two front page murder cases come in. One involving an interesting individual by the name of Willie Bosket that I probably would like to discuss with you after I give the summary.
Sure.
And I did that for a year, and I successfully handled those cases. And then I became a deputy bureau chief. And 3 years later, I became a trial bureau chief. And then in 1984, Morgenthau asked me to go over to special narcotics. And become the number two man there to Sterling Johnson, who was the New York City Special Narcotics Prosecutor. And I really didn't want to go because the office did not have a good reputation. But Morgenthau asked me to go, and I went there and turned the place around. And then when Sterling Johnson became a federal judge, I was unanimously appointed by the five DAs to become the New York City Special Narcotics Prosecutor. And just to give everyone a little background, it's the only office in the country that has citywide jurisdiction and the only office that has the directive to investigate and prosecute felony drug crimes. And I was very lucky during the 7 years I did that about dismantling many dangerous drug gangs that had international implications. I made the biggest drug seizure in New York City history, two tons of cocaine, and did that, as I said, for 7 years. And then I left and I went into the private sector, and which is another interesting story how I got in there, and was headed up the U.S. operations of a company called Forensic Investigative Associates. And then a few years later, I went over to T&M, and I'm now the special counsel to the CEO, Robert Tucker. And that's a brief background.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's interesting. And obviously, we'll talk about the book and kind of just touch upon different things about it. But, you know, you really have had a very, very storied career.
You know, I have a chapter in the book. It's the next to the last chapter, and it talks about how fortuitous life is and about the decisions we all make. And, you know, I always think back, you know, somebody mentioned this job opportunity in the Manhattan DA's office. What would have happened if I didn't follow up? Where would I have been? What would have I done? So as I say in the book, you know, sometimes the life is strange and interesting because we make certain decisions or we don't make certain decisions. And I'm always a believer that the things we regret most in life are the chances that we never took. Right. So I took these chances, and thank God it worked out for me.
It did. So this is probably a very, very unfair question for you, specifically because you know so many people. But can you talk about some of the people that have had a, you know, an influence on your life and career?
Well, I would say the person that really had an influence on my career was Robert Morgenthau, the Manhattan District Attorney. Right. And, you know, he was an interesting guy. His background is very interesting. His great grandfather came to this country from Germany, and in the 1850s, his grandfather made a lot of money in the real estate market and became and was very close to Woodrow Wilson, and he became the U.S. ambassador to Turkey in the Ottoman Empire, and he was the one who revealed about what was going on, the genocide of the Armenians in Turkey. And his son was Henry Morgenthau Jr., and he became Secretary of the Treasury to Franklin Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. And the Morgenthaus were very close to the Roosevelts. And Winston Churchill used to come and meet with Roosevelt, and they would meet at his estate in Hyde Park, and Morgenthau would be there. And Robert Morgenthau, who became district attorney, was there as well, and he used to mix drinks for Winston Churchill, and Churchill always insisted that Morgenthau make him a Bloody Mary. He loved Morgenthau's Bloody Marys. And then Robert Morgenthau, who was also close to the Kennedys, and he ran for governor actually twice, didn't make it. He was not a very good public speaker,
right.
But Kennedy appointed him to be the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, and he was in that position. And I'm going to tell you something that is very interesting. I can't prove it because I never asked Morgenthau this, but it's very interesting. As I said, he was very close to the Kennedys.
Right.
And Morgenthau also was a war hero. He was on two destroyers in the Mediterranean and the Pacific that were both destroyed, and he lost hearing in one ear. But he also made a promise to God that if he survived this, he was going to do something useful with his life. And that was public service. So he became the U.S. attorney for the Southern District. And he was finally removed from that position when Nixon became president. But before that happened, on November the 22nd, 1963, he was meeting with Robert Kennedy in Virginia. And what was going to happen was Robert Kennedy was going to resign as Attorney General and head up the reelection campaign of President Kennedy. And to replace him was going to be Robert Morgenthau.
Hmm.
And as they're having lunch and discussing it, Robert Kennedy gets a call that his brother has been assassinated. And of course, that changed everything. And Lyndon Johnson became president. And Morgenthau went to a public, he was in a law firm, and then he ran against Richard Q in 1975 after Frank Hogan had left the office, and he became the district attorney, and he changed everything.
Right.
He was not only interested in street crime, but as he said, crime in the suites are just as important as crime in the streets. And that's when he went, you know, after all these big players, he went after Martha Stewart, he went after the president of Tyco. And what happened was, all of a sudden, I really had no relationship with Morgenthau. And then one day, he calls me into his office, and he says, you know, a law is passed because of all the publicity that violent juvenile crime had gotten, and the DAs now can prosecute violent juveniles in the family court. And he said, I would like to have you head up that unit. And I had no idea why he selected me. But, I mean, there were 150 other DAs, a lot of them more experienced than me. I'd been in the office maybe 3 years. And he asked me to form and head up that unit. And that experience, because of two cases I tried, changed my whole career and my whole life.
Yeah. Yeah,
and that was the Willie Boskett case and the Laughing Boy murder case.
You know, I got to tell you, one of my favorite things about the book, your sense of humor obviously comes across in the writing of the book, but also this sort of your commentary related to District Attorney Morgenthau and, you know, like,
yeah.
His mannerisms and his the way he handled things. I bet you he didn't take the stuff you gave him from a lot of people.
Well, he knew that I had a good heart and my intentions were right, but he actually liked some of the stuff. You know, I used to consider him like the Pope. So I would see him and I would kneel down and take his hand and kiss his ring. And he would just love that. He thought that was great. And you're right, not too many people in the office could have done that. But but I did. And I also called him the High Kebab, which was and he got a kick out of those things. But you're right, not that many people in the office could have done those things. But he appreciated humor. It was good.
So let me ask you something. When you as I mentioned to you, like in our private conversations and reading the book, I really felt like it was a history book told through your eyes. But
yes,
you know, what is it that when you decided to write the book, right? What is the message you wanted to get across?
Well, a few
things. Was
one. I'll tell you exactly the reasoning behind the book. People told me for years, you have so many stories, you know so many people, you've met so many people, you should really write a book. Well, that was great, but, I was working, I was busy, and then I said to myself, if I'm going to write this book, I should have done it 20 years ago. And then the pandemic hit, and I said, well, now I have time to write the book. And honestly, it was a memoir, but it turned into a love story. And when I say that, it was a love story about two offices, the Manhattan DA's office on special narcotics, and the cops and the agents that I was honored to work with that made these cases. I always say, you know, when you're the head of an agency, you get all the credit, but you do it on the backs of the people who made those cases, the agents and the cops and the assistant DAs. And I always made it a point to recognize that they were the real stars. You know, not me. I got a lot of the credit. In fact, you know, when I left, there were a number of newspaper articles. One called me the secret stealth weapon against crime, because I try to stay in the background. I was the stealth weapon against crime. And then the New York, that was from the New York Daily News. And then there was another article about Crackbuster retiring, which was very nice and so forth. So, you know, and when I had my going away dinner, which was at the New York Athletic Club, it was sold out. You know, over 300 people were there. People flew in from California, from Florida. And, the other thing was I was honored and gotten given plaques by over 20 organizations, including Governor Pataki. So it was a very moving experience for me. And I wanted to write about all that. But I also wanted to write and tell people what was going on during those years in New York. You know, people now, Fahad, who are in their 20s, their 30s, their 40s, they have no idea what was going on in New York in those years, with the graffiti, with the street crime, with the juvenile crime, with the drugs. And I wanted to give my personal views on a lot of topics, about those topics, about drug legalization and so forth, about progressive DAs. And this was my opportunity to do that, which I did in the last, you know, chapter of the book.
Yeah.
So I got it all out of my system.
And again, like I said, for anyone interested in sort of the way the system works, you know, sort of the changes, the progression, all that sort of stuff, I mean, this is a really good sort of book for that. But, you know, it's interesting also, I got to tell you, like certain things, like as I read about it, it's like some things are different, but some things are still the same, right? Like some of the problems are still very, very similar. And that's always interesting. By the way, we did an episode it's been a while, with Ed Hartnett, who I know you know, about how we got back to, you know, the crime levels from the 80s and 90s and, you know, stuff like that. So that was an interesting sort of episode. But, you know, again, some things do feel like we really haven't progressed much, and others feel like we do, and others feel like we went downhill. So I'm sure you'd agree with that.
I think that we're headed back to the bad old days.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at it, you know, when I came to Special Narcotics in 1984, you know, we did more search warrants and more wiretaps than any office in the country and dismantled all these drug gangs. But there was so much street crime then. And then Giuliani came in, Bratton came in, and Ray Kelly came in with Bloomberg. Yeah. And you saw this historic reduction in crime.
Yeah.
I mean, New York has levels very low. New York became the safest city in the country. And that was great. And now in the last 5 to 10 years, you've seen this reversal.
Yeah.
We've seen all these crimes that are taking place. And what's disturbing to me is you saw this in Philadelphia, you see it in LA, in San Francisco, these flash mobs of kids that just go into a store and just take everything that's there and run out without any fear of punishment.
Yeah.
And I find that very scary because to me that's almost like anarchy. When people just go in, they have no fear of anything and they, you know, they rob these merchants and they commit crimes and they're not, you know. So I think we're headed back right now to the bad old days. Plus you have all the problems with opioids and fentanyl and everything. It's not a good situation.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, anyone that lived through that, again, like the younger folks, you know, perhaps can't feel what it felt like then, but anyone that lived through New York City at that time, man, that's not a place we want to get back to. So, again, your book, you know, we had been to, you had filled me in, even during the pandemic, that you were working on this, and then that's sort of the inspiration for getting together with you today. And so,
yeah,
you know, I was hoping you could talk a little bit. Some of this is maybe a little philosophical, but I think it's important to hear from you. So what does the concept of law mean to you? What does that mean to you? Because your book is called Law and Disorder. So I want to dissect those two things a little bit and hear from you
right. What
your thoughts on that are.
Well, to me, law means justice. It means fairness. It means that all people should be treated the same under the law. And I always say, for example, if two people get arrested and commit a robbery and they have a similar criminal record, one should not get 5 to 15 years in jail and the other guy gets, you know, 8 to 24 years in jail. So we should have fairness, we should have consistency, and that people and criminals should be treated alike. And, you know, there's a funny story about justice. My predecessor, Sterling Johnson, was giving a speech it's in the book even, was giving a speech at Harvard, and he was being heckled by someone in the balcony. And the guy kept yelling, what about justice? What about justice? And Sterling just went on, and the guy kept going on, well, what about justice? And finally Sterling looks up at him and he says, you want to know about justice? I'll tell you what justice is. Justice is a statue in the middle of the courtyard that the pigeons shit on. That's what justice is. But in all reality, justice really means fairness, consistent treatment, and everyone being treated fairly and honestly. And sometimes we don't have that in our system.
Yeah.
But I think it's something we really have to strive for.
No, I hear you. So, and what is disorder within the context of the way you thought about it in your book? What does that mean?
Crime and chaos and the breakdown of society, and I think we have a little bit of that now.
Yeah.
And you know, look, I'm old school, but I see these progressive DAs that are being coming in. Now, I see it in Manhattan, Chicago, Philadelphia, LA, San Francisco. And it's interesting, in San Francisco, there was a recall of the progressive DA there. And there was a petition to recall the DA in LA as well. And what I find interesting is that none of these progressive DAs ever worked in a district attorney's office. They may have worked in an attorney general's office or a U.S. attorney's office, but the volume of cases is so much greater in a local DA's office that people don't realize it. So these prosecutors come in and they really don't have a knowledge or appreciation of what goes on in a district attorney's office. And that's one of the things I try to do with the book, where I lay out what happens in a DA's office and the number of cases. Now, I'll go back 30 years ago when Rudy Giuliani was the U.S. attorney in Manhattan. And he wanted to, and we were inundated with drug cases. Crack arrests were everywhere. And Rudy says, you know what? We'll have a federal day. We'll take some of these cases from you. Okay. Well, the truth of the matter is that we did more cases in a week than the U.S. Attorney's Office did in a year. And after a while, he said, enough. I can't handle this anymore. And that's the truth of the matter. And I think a lot of these guys come in with these preconceived notions that we're going to change everything and there's going to be a presumption, as they did in Manhattan, where Brad comes in and he says a presumption of non-incarceration. Well, DAs are not social workers. You know, we're here to make sure that justice is done, that innocent people are not prosecuted, and that guilty people are prosecuted and treated fairly.
Right.
So I hope that answers the question.
Yeah, no, I mean, so look, it can't, what do you think, what do you think's like better and what do you think is worse? I think you just went through what's not great, but what do you think might be better today than it was during your time?
I think though that what's happened is that there's a more of an attempt today to treat people fairly and more evenly under the law. And I think that's good. And I think that the bail system does need some changes, and I think that's good. And I think one of the biggest and most important changes involves the police and, you know, training the police to do a job fairly. You know, look, there's always been a lot of racism in terms of dealing with people of color. And, you know, I think the police departments and officers need more training in dealing with people from that community. You know, I've always said you take someone who grew up in the sticks, let's say, in, you know, northern Westchester, and they lived in a white community, and now you're throwing them into Harlem, and they have a preconceived notion that all these people are evil, they're bad. And, you know, we can't have that. So I think the what's going on now, and there is a lot more sensitivity training and training and how to deal with people that are going on in the police department. I think that's very good. I think we need that.
So, you know, our audience loves anecdotes, right? And our show is called Investigation Insiders. So we try to at the layers, and we talk about things that maybe are not widely out there, right? So you share quite a few in your book, and it's often said that, you know, like what people perceive, what they see on TV and in movies and, you know, things like that, what it's really like. But I got to tell you, some of your stories did feel like the movies, like the one with Jerry Speciale in with following
the tomato cans.
Yes. So, but you know, one which stuck out in my mind was the Willie Bosket case, which you alluded to earlier, right? Can you talk about that a little bit? Because I thought, you know, aside from the case itself and, you know, the subject, I mean, that had a lot larger ramification, right?
Yes, it did. It did. Yeah. It had nationwide ramifications. So I'll talk about it, and there's a few side stories to it that are very interesting.
Yeah.
So Willie Bosket was And you know, I just want to recommend a book to your followers and that, your listeners, and that's a book called All God's Children by Fox Butterfield, which talks about the Boscott family and how they took their name from the plantation they worked on in the 1850s in South Carolina. And it turns out that there are generations of violent criminals and murderers in that family. And Willie Boscott had a father who he never met but idolized by the name of Willie Boscott Sr., or Butch Boscott. And Butch was a very bright guy, but he committed two murders in a pawn shop, and he gets jailed, and he goes to prison. And while in prison, he is the only prisoner in American history to get his PhD while in prison. And he escapes, and he dies in a shootout with the police. He actually commits suicide. So Willie, at 15, idolizes his father. He's a kid of the streets. And ever since he was like 7 years old, he had committed violent crimes and was in all these juvenile facilities, and none of them really did any good for him. He was a violent guy. He would hit people over the head with a chair. He would light their beds on fire. He would do all these things. Well, in 1978, he had a cousin by the name of Herman Spates, who was 18 years old. But Herman was not the smartest guy in the world. He followed Willie, and they'd go on the trains. And when the trains were fairly deserted, they would find somebody who was asleep, and they would rob him. And they robbed one guy. He woke up, and Willie shot him for no reason. Shoots him in the eye, and to make sure he's dead, he shoots him again in the head. That was Moises Perez. And then a few days later, he ends up shooting another individual by the same name, Perez, and he robs him, and he kills Perez. A few days after that, he sees a motorman in the subways, and the guy comes over to question him, and Willie shoots him and tries to kill him, but the guy survives. He also had committed a number of robberies. He beat up and robbed a 70-year-old man in the Bronx, threw him down a flight of steps. So you could see he was vicious. And finally, he gets arrested. And he's interviewed by an assistant DA by the name of Harvey Rosen. And he says to Harvey, he says, "I wouldn't use a gun on you. I would just use a knife and stab you." And the interesting part of this is he gets caught, and he's 15. So he can only be prosecuted in the juvenile court, receive a sentence of up to 5 years in what they call a restrictive placement, which is, it's not a prison. It's just like a locked room. So an interesting young prosecutor who worked for the city by the name of Judy Levy, later became Judith Scheinlin. You may know her as Judge Judy. She worked in the family court, and comes to see me and says, "Look, this guy, you can't let this guy out. He's got to be prosecuted. He's a dangerous person and a danger to society." So we prosecute Willie, and there's nothing. It's not called the conviction. It's a fact-finding hearing in the family court. And he gets found that he had committed these acts, and he's sentenced to 5 years in a restricted facility. While these hearings are taking place, and he has an IQ of 130, and he's very disarming. He's a handsome guy with a smile. And after I cross-examined his mother on the stand, by the way, the mother was the one who actually told the police where the gun was. She was scared of him as well. He goes into a fury. He threatens to kill the judge. He threatens to kill me, and he spits at me, and he's let out of the courtroom. And Herman now had decided that he was going to testify against Willie. Willie's lawyer comes into court, and he says, "I'm fed up. I'm pleading guilty." And the reason he decided to plead guilty was he didn't want his cousin to go to prison and be known as a rat. The Willie pleads guilty. While he's in prison, or while he's in this restrictive facility, he escapes. And he gets convicted now as an adult because the age of adulthood in New York is 16. He gets convicted as a felon. Then, when he's released, he comes looking for me. I was no longer the chief of the family court. And I go to work the next morning, and there are two detectives sitting in my office. Why are you guys here? Well, you don't know. Willie Bosket came looking for you. And, you know, we're gonna have protection for you. So I had a bodyguard for about 6 weeks, and I had to wear a bulletproof vest. Willie eventually robs an elderly man and gets arrested and convicted. That's his second felony.
Right.
While he's in jail, he lights his jail cell on fire and his bed in the jail. And now he gets convicted, believe it or not, of arson. It's his third felon. And the judge sentences him as a persistent felony offender, which means he gets a life sentence with a minimum of 15 years.
Wow.
So he's in jail, and I got a call a few years later from a reporter who worked upstate, a fellow by the name of Matt Worth. And he says, I've spoken to Willie, and I'm thinking of writing a book about Willie, and I'd like to see Willie. So I said, you're making a mistake. He says, why? He says, don't be fooled. This kid is a volcano. He can erupt at any time. And he's going to fool you because he's a handsome kid with a smile, and he's very ingratiating. Worth says, I have no problem. I'm going to go speak to him. So he goes upstate to the prison that he's in, and they start an interview. And during the interview, Willie says, I got to go to the bathroom. So he goes to the bathroom, and he comes out, and he turns around, and he's got a shiv, and he stabs the guard that's escorting him, just missing his heart.
Mm.
And he then says he tries to lead a prison riot at the same time. But he's unsuccessful. He's apprehended. He's now convicted of the attempted murder of this guard named Earl Porter. He gets now 25 to life. And what happens is he is now imprisoned. He's the only prisoner in New York history, state history, to be imprisoned in a plexiglass cell where he's monitored 24 hours a day. And he gets 1 hour a day off to walk in the prison yard. But he had no access to anybody else. He was basically solitary. And it was only now that he's reached close to 60 years of age that they took him out of that and put him in a regular jail cell. But as a result of this case, and another case that was very sad, and they called it the Laughing Boy murder case, in which a 15-year-old seminary student was sitting with a friend near Columbia University, and this 13-year-old kid comes over to him and says, what are you laughing at? And McAvoy, who was the boy's name, says, nothing, not anything. And this other kid, who's 13, by the name of Felipe Olavi, takes out a gun and shoots him in the head and kills him. And those two cases changed the law in New York. And what the change was that 13-year-olds could be tried as an adult for murder, and they could receive a maximum sentence of 9 to life. And 14 and 15-year-olds could also be tried as adults for not only murder, but for manslaughter, for rape, for robbery with a gun, and assault. And that changed the law in New York forever. And not only that, it changed, that case led to other states changing the law as well and allowing juveniles to be tried as adults. So it really had quite an interesting case. And I will tell you this, that as I said, Fox Butterfield wrote a book about tracing the Boscobe family from the Civil War all the way down to the present times. And the rights to that book have now been sold. And it looks like there's going to be a movie made or a documentary made about Boscobe or the Boscobe family. So it's got an interesting history.
Are they going to have you in that? Or
Well, I hope so. Or they'll probably have maybe Brad Pitt or, or George Clooney portray me, yes.
Yeah, that's I mean, that would be the likely.
Yeah, or in actuality, they probably should have Danny DeVito portray me, but yeah.
Well, didn't you say something about that, like in your retirement?
Yes.
Yeah, what was the...
People asked me, was this a tough job? And I said, well, when I started the job, I was 6'2" and had dark blonde hair, and I looked like a young Robert Redford.
Right.
And then when I left the job 25 years later, I came out looking like Danny DeVito. because there is a lot of pressure in that job. I mean, dealing with people's lives and you're making decisions. Are they innocent? Are they guilty? How much time they should get and so forth.
Yeah.
And, I always watch Law and Order because I know that's, such a popular show. And you see, sometimes you see the prosecutor in a room and he's sitting opposite the defendant and his attorney. And the prosecutor says, okay, we're gonna charge you with manslaughter one, and we're going to give you 8 to 25 years. And the defense attorney speaks to his client, and they say, how about man two, 5 to 15? And then they settle for 8 to 21. Well, something? That doesn't happen. I can tell you, 25 years, I never sat across from a defendant and discussed his sentence with him. It just doesn't happen. I mean, you watch all these police shows and everything, and let's face it, cases are not solved in 52 minutes, and summations don't take 2 minutes. I never gave a summation that was less than a half hour. But, and that was another reason I tried to write the book, was to tell people this is how the system works. Plea bargains are done with discussions with the prosecutor and the defense attorney, and then the judge signs off on it.
Right.
And that's really how the system works.
So, that's where I think for anyone that's in the business or in this government sector or looking to get into it or just has interest in it, that's where I just think your book has just great appeal. So let's talk a little bit about some general things, right? So what do you think has led to your success in both the government and the private sector?
Well, one, I think the most important thing is common sense and judgment. And I've always had a common sense approach to dealing with things. Before I make important decisions, what are the pros and what are the cons? And I've always had a very good ability to deal with people and to evaluate them and their credibility. And I think that's really helped me quite a bit. I've always found that people who really lack common sense and naive or are naive, they don't make it. You have to be able to understand people and to be able to deal with them and have a common sense approach. And that's what I've always had. I mean, I rarely raise my voice. I don't think I can remember ever raising my voice to people, and just trying to be fair with people. And, it's funny. I had lunch with one of my former assistants, and he said, what we always liked about you was we knew what we were getting. Not only was your door open, you always spoke reasonably and with common sense, but you never had any whims. You were consistent. Every time we came in to speak to you, we know what we were getting. And I think those are important traits. And the ability to deal with colleagues and people. And I think that's really what led to my success. Morgenthau called me into his office when he asked me to go to Special Narcotics. And I said, why are you asking me to go down there? And he says to me, I need someone who can handle, who has good judgment and can deal with people and get that place back together. And you're that guy. And that's how I got down there.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, I agree with that. I mean, ever since we've met, I could tell you two things. And it's certainly, like, again, your book, everything that you've said, and I'm sure many, many, many people that you would know, is A, that respect factor. I think you show everyone respect. And then B, just listening, right? I mean, so you take things in really well and sort of make adjustments and offer an opinion once you have enough information. So what have you enjoyed? Obviously, the book mainly focuses on the government career, right? What have you enjoyed about your government career?
About my I love.
Yeah, post government.
I love dealing. I love, you know, dealing with people, and I love trying to do the right thing. And nothing made me feel better than when I got a call from a woman, and after we took down this violent drug gang that was operating in the housing projects, and she said, you know, my children couldn't walk the streets without being accosted by drug dealers. I was always afraid of being robbed. And she called me up and she said, I just want to thank you for doing that, because now we can start hopefully to live a normal life. And things like that, you know, really, you know, make you feel good about what you've done. And, you know, the other thing is, I always had a lot of patience. And, you know, I'll tell you one thing. When a lawyer came into my office, an assistant, he was on trial. And he said, I have a question for you. I need some help. He never left my office without an answer, because that's why he came to see me. And, you know, I always have a saying that indecision is a decision not to make a decision.
Sure.
Indecision is a decision to do nothing. And that's the one thing I always guarded against, was being indecisive. You have to make decisions, and you hope they're the right ones. And that's where common sense and judgment come in.
Sure. What about after leaving the government? What have you liked about the private sector? Like, again, you've had a lot of success in the private sector as well.
Yeah. One thing that made me successful was a lot of the people that I had dealt with, and I helped them get jobs in law firms, and I helped them, and they came back and said, you know, we want you to work on these matters. And so I always felt good about that, and I always felt good about getting answers for people, and you know, being successful in an investigation and getting the right thing done. You know, I still remember one matter where I got a call from a financial institution, and they said, we want you to check out this matter in Turkey. We understand you had an office in Greece, in Cyprus. And I said, sure. And they said, well, this guy is a banker in Turkey. He runs this bank, and he's very wealthy. And what he wants to do is sell the bank, and he wants to become a high net worth investor with us. And I called our guy in Cyprus, and I said, well, what do you think? Find out about this guy. He said, comes back to me, and he says, well, the guy is very wealthy. He's been very successful, and so forth. But there's just one issue. I said, well, what's that? He says, the guy is a Muslim, and he is running, he is laundering money and donating money to Hezbollah.
Mm.
And I said, how do you know that? He says, because we have contacts with Hezbollah. And what I found out was, when the British were the powers in the Middle East, the Cyprus intelligence people were the go-betweens between the Arabs and the Israelis, so they had contacts with Hezbollah. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, So the bank now says, forget it. You know, we're not going to touch this guy. And 2 years later, there's an article in the Wall Street Journal about him. So that felt good that we, you know, we were right on the money on that. And, you know, the other thing was, it was very interesting, you know, being involved in the movie industry where I got asked to be a consultant or a technical advisor on the movie Presumed Innocent. And also doing some of that for the TV show NYPD Blue and meeting some of these actors and so forth. So, you know, I've had an interesting life. And, you know, an interesting second life being in the private sector. And like you, you know, you find that this work is interesting. You feel good when you help people out and get them decision, you know, answers and save them from being scammed and so forth. You know, listen, that's got to make everybody feel good. And I'm sure it makes you feel good when you and your associates are successful as you are almost all the time in getting answers to their problems.
No, for sure. No doubt
and,
about
and let me just say something. Let me just say something, which we haven't discussed. And you have a lot of listeners out there, and they listen to you, and they hear you. But they don't see you, and they don't meet you. And they get an impression from hearing about you, you know, listening to the podcast. But for those of you who don't know Fahad, you're dealing with a very decent and honest man, and I am very happy about our friendship because, you know, I have always said I'm pretty good about evaluating people, and in my estimation, you know, you're a very honest and decent human being, and that the clients that hire you can feel comfortable in knowing that you're going to do the best you can to answer their questions and solve their problems. And that should be reassuring to people.
Thank you. Thank you so much for saying that, Bob. And I think that's...
Well, yeah. You know, Fahad, you know me. I'm very honest. I say what I feel. And I think that's the truth. I think that, you know, they can probably discern that from hearing you and the way you handle things on the podcast, but they never, you know, get a chance to deal with you and to meet you. And if you do, you feel very comfortable in your presence because your decency just eases, you know, it oozes out. You're a decent guy who I think is a family man who tries to do the right thing. And you know, there's not that many of you around, to be honest. And I've seen people, in this business that, you know, to be honest, that I haven't trusted, and they're just out to make a quick buck, and that's the bottom line. And that is certainly not you.
Thank you so much, Bob. And you know, I guess the last thing that I want to ask you about before we cut this off.
Yeah, because you know I got to take a nap. I'm getting old and I need my rest. So
yes. I know about your nap. You're infamous. Advice do you have for young professionals trying to figure their way through their careers, just like you did, just like I did? What would you say to those folks?
One thing I'd say is patience. Don't do anything abruptly. Think before you act. And the other thing is, it's very important to speak to people and get their perspective on things. I'll just tell you that when I left the government, I had no business experience at all. I didn't know what, I get paid by the government. I don't get paid by private clients. So I spoke to a lot of people who were a lot smarter than I was about going into business. And they gave me great information and great tips, and I use that. And, you know, even when I came into the DA's office, I had mentors who really helped me and put their arm around me and said, this is what you should do. And I think that's important. I think being patient, asking the right questions, don't do anything abruptly, and speak to people and get their opinions. And even my kids today call me and ask me my opinion on things. And not that they listen to me, but they ask my opinion. But I think that's very important for young people.
Yeah, I think that's a great conclusion to the show, Bob. I just really, again, want to thank you. Well, first of all, your service, obviously, to New York, the country, the world, really. I mean, because the work that you did actually had global impact. And second, again, just for being a friend and saying many, many kind things about myself on the show. And, you know, I wish you the best of luck with this book and whatever you decide to do with the rest of your, I mean, again, you're still working. So whatever it is that you choose to do. The best.
Well, so, one thing I could tell you, there will never be a second book. This one took everything out of me. I could have written another 50 pages or so, but I ran out of steam. But yeah. Anyway, if the readers want to read it, it's, Law and Disorder, How a Kid from the Bronx Became America's Top Drug Prosecutor. They can get it on Amazon or whatever, and I hope they enjoy it. And I certainly enjoyed our time together today. It's always a pleasure to speak to you, my friend.
Thank you so much. And just for everyone listening, thank you for the support. Thank you for the comments. We're going to put Bob's information in the description, as well as where you could pick up his book. And obviously, if you need to reach out to him, you could do that directly or through us. So till next time, thank you very much.
Don't forget to follow us. We are on LinkedIn and Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube.